welcome to Melanated Social Work. I'm Josh, coming live to you from the City of Champions.
This is Michael in Williamstown.
Yo, this is Jesse. I'm out here in Oakland, California.
And this is Marvin. I'm here in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. And we are very excited for episode 7. We have a very special guest, Sonali. Say your last name so I mess it up.
Sonali Rishatwar.
So going to learn a little bit about Sonali, her journey, and the work that she does here in Philadelphia. Josh, you want to give a couple updates and shout-outs?
First and foremost, just want to shout out our top 5 listener cities. We have Philadelphia first.
Hey.
Top city, most listeners.
Philly.
And then we have my favorite city, New York City. Then after that, we have the City of Champions. Thank you so much. Then we have Oakland, California, I want to say. And then we have Charlotte, North Carolina. What's up, Charlotte? And then last, and certainly but not least, honorable mention, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Shout out to Minneapolis.
Shout out to Minneapolis, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Yes, Morris sir. Day and the Time, and Prince.
Yes, sir.
Prince.
Yes. I also want to give a shout out to all the social workers, therapists, caseworkers that provide, support to those, dealing with domestic violence, interpersonal violence. This is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but as social workers and therapists and healers, it's Domestic Violence Awareness every day for us. So give some credence to that. Also, I just want to give a quick moment of silence for Tatiana Jefferson. Thank you. So thank you for everybody who voted for us to do South by Southwest. We unfortunately did not make it this year. We really appreciate support. We appreciate the love. We appreciate the votes, the reposts, the shares. And thank you, South by Southwest, for at least considering us. We got put to be like a backup, but we didn't make the final cut. So just thank you. Thank you, everybody who supported us for South by Southwest. Hopefully 2021 will be our year. Now we have Sonali. Sonali comes to us from the city of brotherly love, the city that probably made some Bostonians need to go seek some therapy because that's their last Super Bowl loss.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you, Philadelphia Eagles, for humbling some of these obnoxious New Englanders. But first and foremost, did a little research on you. Marvin speaks highly of you. He always says you're dope, and I definitely, I've seen that. Real interested to, hear a little bit about how you got into the social work field, and what motivates you.
First of all, I have to say it's an honor to be here. I'm a huge fan of the podcast. My name is Sonali Rishatwar. I use she and they pronouns. It's important for me to say that because I feel like people can't tell just by hearing a voice sometimes what someone's gender is. Mm-hmm. And to normalize like asking and using pronouns because at Radical Therapy Center, that's how I know Marvin. That's where both of us work. At Radical Therapy Center, we are a queer trans-centered practice. So most of our clients are folks who are of the LGBTQ plus umbrella. But before we get into that, I do want to say again, thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm a little bit nervous because the list of questions that you gave me were so well researched that I am nervous, but I'm excited. I have really good answers for all of these things. And to answer your first question, to kind of describe how I got into social work, it was completely by accident. I'm not one of those career professionals who knew what they wanted to be when they were like 10 or 15 or maybe even 25. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who was in the social work program here just outside Philadelphia, and she was in the same program, the sex therapy program at Widener University, which is about 20 minutes south of Philadelphia. If I had not had this like chance dinner with her, I would never have known about the program. I would never have considered sex therapy as as a career. I would never have known social work had so many career applications. I could have worked in a hospital. Mm-hmm. I could have worked in a Fortune 500 company as like a contracted therapist. Mm-hmm. I could work anywhere. And so where I started actually was in community mental health at a nonprofit in South Jersey that offered free sexual violence services to those who had experienced trauma and were interested in free counseling. And that's how I cut my teeth as a social worker, as a baby social worker.
Yeah, welcome to the field, right?
I love being
Well, thank you. Yes, yes. And you, I think you graduated in 2016, I want to say, correct?
I did. You are really good at your research.
I try.
He's like, we actually have a copy of your transcript here. When I ask you,
oh no, this
class right here.
Like we don't want that transcript, huh?
Well, what had happened was,
yeah. So you have an MSW, but you also have a master's in human sexuality, correct?
Yeah. So the program at Widener is one of the only in the country that offers a combined dual degree program. So within 3 years, I left with two master's degrees. The primary was the clinical master's in social work. So I was able to leave with the clinical experience that I would need to be a clinician, a clinical social worker. And then the second master's degree was a master's in education in human sexuality. Okay. And that also offered a clinical track. So I was taking courses that were sex therapy focused. So that I would leave with the kind of training where I could work with clients, like individuals, couples, polyamorous, what we call polycules, and folks in general who are experiencing sexual dysfunction or sexuality-related issues.
Cool.
Could you give a definition of polycules?
Yeah. So a polycule is what we call a polyamorous couple. But for those who are polyamorous, sometimes it's more than two people. So we can't really call them a couple. So we call them a polycule, like a molecule.
Mm-hmm. Oh, knowledge. He dropping bars out here.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit about what fat phobia is?
Yeah. So this is kind of the meat of my work these days as a radical educator who is offering free political education content through the platform Instagram right now. And a lot of my freelancing work. So I'm not just a clinical social worker. I also do a lot of freelancing education on the side. And so that involves like universities reaching out to me sometimes because they're familiar with my work through Instagram to have me come out because students have requested me to come to campus to offer like a workshop or like a conversation about different topics around fat phobia. Mm-hmm. And what I would like to add to the conversation that feels like it's happening in this like cultural moment around body positivity is to remind folks who are interested in kind of mainstream body positivity, this idea that like we should love and accept our bodies regardless of what they look like. The root of that idea or the origins of those ideas come from actually really radical activist movements like disability justice activists and radical fat liberation activists. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of those movements were to talk about structural discrimination that was being experienced by super duper fat people and super duper disabled people. And what happens is that those ideas got often co-opted by folks who, not that they don't need those ideas any less, but that they become co-opted and the message becomes diluted and mainstreamed and created just for like already conventionally attractive, usually thin, cisgender, heterosexual white women.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you mention that because through some research, I actually read an article, and one of the articles, I think you mentioned The Fear of the Black Body by Dr. Sabrina Strings. And she actually quoted Sarah Osefahel, I believe, from Godey's magazine. Sarah Osefahel was actually from New England, and she was really adamant about a lifestyle for white women that stem from a perspective that it was fashionable to be thin, but if anything was close to being the opposite of that, that was of the grotesque class. Mm-hmm. And there was also a notion of fatness is only priced in Africa. And then Dr. Sabrina Strings also talked about, even in a sense, John Harvey Kellogg, who was a doctor, who we know is from Kellogg cereal, thought it should be better for white women to gain weight instead of lose weight, partly due to the lower races will eventually die off. And he was a segregationist. Mm-hmm. That was a foster parent to black children. So, yes, white people, you can love people of color, black people, you can have children with them, do this, you can adopt them and still be racist.
Sonali, I'm curious about, like, because we've talked about this amongst ourselves as well, in terms of where does liberation and where does activism and radical movement, and how does that either align with social work or, like, things that I guess we felt were lacking in our social work education? Like, at what point in your process of becoming a social worker in that, did you really start to frame liberation as a part of that process and know that this was going to, like, guide the work for you?
Mm. I think grad school for me was a really difficult time. I almost dropped out from the program several times because of how racist and white supremacist it was. Mm. So not just, like, the curriculum being completely white-centric. It's not just that. It's also, like, administrators who would favor white classmates, who would give the very few classmates of color that I had a hard time. And so grad school for me was a really radicalizing moment. Mm. There were none. There were no Asians in the class. So there were no very few non-black people of color in my cohort. And so at that time, I started becoming interested in community organizing because I so desperately needed radical South Asian community to make me feel like I was not this isolated, politicized Indian person who was also, like, queer, who was also thinking about gender in this different way because of my fatness. I grew up as a fat kid. And so that, for me, that messed with my gender in really important ways, which I'd be happy to talk about. Mm-hmm. So for me, I didn't see myself reflected in social work, in our curriculum, in the way that we were thinking about the populations who we would service, like immigrants, like I'm a child of immigrants. The way we think about assimilation is really different. So when I think about in my sex ed classes, we were talking about sex positivity and how we should really embrace this idea that, like, sex could be great and that most sex that we're having is good and should be celebrated. But for me, as, like, an immigrant kid, I knew I started having sex too early because I was trying to assimilate and I was trying to, like, I was trying to look more like my classmates and, like, and it wasn't good. It was, like, really risky, inappropriate behavior for me that was related to growing up in a family with emotionally immature parents, which is a framework that's really been a running theme in therapy for me in the last couple of months.
Yes, it is with a lot of us.
Don't you fucking hate therapy? Why do we do it? Why do we do it? But I do want to go back actually and answer your original question about what is fatphobia. So for me, it is this understanding that there is a structural experience of discrimination that exists based on body size. Mm-hmm. It can exist based on BMI or body mass index as well. So when we think about medical fat phobia, which is a specific type of fat phobia, it's also structural. And when I say structural, I mean it's not like an event, it's a structure. Like there are macro levels, meso, micro levels that we can experience fat phobia that can affect the way that we receive a job at a job interview. Because I think more than 50% of recruiters reported on a study that they would not hire a fat person if they had an option to hire a thin person. That's structural fat phobia.
Yeah.
When we think about medical fat phobia, I think about how when an individual is over a certain number on the BMI scale, which is a completely debunked metric that fat positive social workers and dietitians and nutritionists do not use anymore. But for individuals who are over that certain number, that certain metric on the BMI, they can be denied top surgery, which is gender affirming and can reduce trans suicide. They can be rejected and denied joint replacement surgery, which can greatly reduce the amount of pain and hypertension that someone could experience due to that pain. They can also be denied in vitro fertilization and fertility treatment based on that number alone. And that's aside from like being denied insurance coverage.
I was, you said you spoke about BMI, and I think I was reading that BMI is actually almost, if not almost like obsolete, and how a lot of times BMI is used in a sense of like a Eurocentric way of looking at height and weight and bone structure, bone density, and how sometimes really if you go to your doctor, they have to put your weight on something just for the insurance purposes and what have you. And that actually leads me to my next question. As far as how does fat phobia relate to white supremacy?
So fat phobia is a tool of white supremacy. So in Dr. Sabrina String's book, what she really lays out so well is that the purpose of fat phobia, especially when we think about this U.S. specific context, was to establish a colonial binary where colonizers, especially European colonizers who were white, often thin, often ate very different food from the places that they were traveling to in order to like enslave individuals, in order to plunder and steal. Mm-hmm. When the binary was created, it was to establish civilized over savage. And so what was chosen were really arbitrary aspects of who they were going to deem savage in order to rationalize their colonialism and their theft and their enslavement and their plundering. And so what Dr. Sabrina Strings wrote about is that race scientists in the late 1800s, especially, and then in the early 1900s, and that's just given the research that she offered, which is brilliant, we're thinking about how fatness was used as a code to denote the type of food someone ate, the type of temperament someone might be, but also how it was associated to phenotype along with Black individuals. When I think back to the images captured around that time, around the late 1800s, I'm thinking of an image taken by Napoleon Bonaparte. And this is an image that I found in Gervais' article that talks about how white supremacy, fat phobia, and colonialism are inherently linked. And there, in this photo, there is offered no context. But what we can see in the image is a fat Black woman who is standing in profile. So you can only see the side of her body, almost like as if it was like she was standing in a 2D way. And what you can see is she has like a full face with a double chin, and she's got fat arms and fat breasts and a fat stomach and a large buttocks and plump thighs and plump calves and like what we would call cankles. And there's offered no context of this image, but what we can guess is the purpose of this image, especially from what we know about the existence of human zoos and from what little information we have about Sarah Bartman, is that the purpose of this image, right, is to establish this colonial binary of like thin, white, civilized, and fat, Black, savage.
So there's actually, I think, so that's on the cover of Fear of the Black Body. I think that's who you're describing, Sarah Bartman, or as some have called maybe Hottentot Venus. And I think that she passed away in Paris, and her remains are actually in South Africa. And how at that time, even I think there was somebody named Ota Benga, who was actually an African that was put in zoos and sideshows, and she was kind of put in that realm because there was a lot of fascination with Blackness, but in a very inhumane fashion, as you were speaking about.
Yep. So even Sarah Bartman's genitals were considered inappropriate or like too large or like too fat. And so absolutely her remains may have gone back to South Africa where she was from. Mm-hmm. But her genitals still remain removed from her body, removed mm-hmm. from even her body in death, and on display mm-hmm. in a museum in Europe.
Damn.
Wow. Yeah.
Isn't that awful? People. And they want to talk about savages.
Mm-hmm.
And now I guess it's cool for Kim Kardashian to have her do what she's doing, you know?
Yeah, you can get a profit off it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've heard that you've caught
hey, yo,
some
yo, we're going to have some Kim K stands hitting us up real quick.
Man,
Kim K hey, stands are not listening to the Melanie and Social Work podcast. What about that?
Also, like, Kim Kardashian has been called out by other celebrities, like even Jamila Jamil, mm-hmm. who has been talking about how, you know, large celebrities with huge platforms like the Kardashians often will promote these like really gimmicky fad diet products that are often mm-hmm. laxatives in like a sugar coating. So like mm-hmm. Diet lollipops and tummy teas and things like that, like products that actually the Kardashians are definitely not using because they have these like expensive plastic surgeons and like personal trainers and like personal chefs and like airbrushing experts.
Yeah.
Right,
so, resources.
You know, I was gonna say they have the resources, and we can read between the lines. But for a lot of young people, they take it at the surface.
Exactly, mm-hmm. and so that's why Instagram has actually moved to ban a lot of that advertising that the Kardashians, especially, have been doing around fad diet like products.
Mm-hmm. So you've caught some heat for something you posted on IG about Zionists, and even one of our followers was upset that you posted it. Can you explain a little bit about the situation?
Yeah, totally. Zionists will always be caring too much about what I am posting on the internet. So Zionists are the equivalent of white supremacists. So if that helps at all, great. Zionists are individuals who believe in the illegal settler state of Israel, which exists at the expulsion and genocide of Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of Israeli occupied Palestine, imagine exactly like apartheid South Africa. It is identical. Like, that is our South Africa. So when you think of Mandela, like, that is who you should be thinking of when you think of Palestinian freedom fighters. And the struggle for Black liberation is inherently linked to Palestinian liberation. I'm sorry, I know you did not ask this. But I guess this is where we're going.
Go ahead, preach.
So, like, the companies that manufacture the canisters of tear gas that were thrown at protesters during Ferguson, the Ferguson mm-hmm. uprising, that same manufacturer creates the tear gas that is used on occupied Palestinians by Israeli forces, defense forces.
Mm.
There are so many parallels to the way that Black Americans live under occupation in the U.S. and mm-hmm. Palestinians live under open-air occupation in Palestine. Like, U.S. police forces, like, U.S., mm-hmm. like, little mm-hmm. rinky-dink police departments will receive grant funding to fly out to Israel and receive training by Israeli defense forces on how to better govern their Black populations by looking and training on Palestinian citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
The liberation is inherently tied together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Tom Brady and Robert Kraft go out there and party out with the Israelis as well too. So yeah, go Patriots.
Barf.
So Sonali, what was the post in question that went up?
Yes. So in early January, and I have never not been this vocal about Zionism and how we should be calling out settler states like Israel and the U.S. and India, too. What I had posted in January was talking about how if people are only following my Instagram account because they want to hear about fluffy self-love and how to better fall in love with our bodies and take care of ourselves and self-soothe and have positive internal self-talk, like all valid, valuable topics, absolutely. But if that's all people are interested in, that's like a depoliticized understanding of body liberation. That's a depoliticized understanding of body positivity. Mm. And if they're not here to understand how colonialism is linked to how we think about our bodies, how when the state does not value my body for its like racialized queerness, that, and when I internalize that, that I like put up with nonsense that I shouldn't be putting up with, when I don't connect these movements, this like politicized understanding of the worth of my body, then it's like, it's a failed movement. It's not holding the state accountable. It's not holding actually violent institutions accountable. And so what I had posted was about how this is why I talk about Zionism. This is why I talk about Palestinian rights, Palestinian liberation, and how if we can't talk about Palestine, which is like one of those things that can, you know, knock people off their tenure track. Professors who are trying to get tenure will not be considered because Israel and the occupation of Palestine is such a touchy issue that people can lose their jobs over this. It's very similar to any other political opinion about anti-blackness or any criticalness of the U.S. government and the state. So that's what I had posted. I posted that, like, you know, don't follow me for my fluffiness if you're not here for the understanding that, like, colonialism and Palestinian liberation, just for one example, is absolutely connected to body positivity. And Palestinian occupation is a body image issue. That's like my one flagship lecture that I do that I like take internationally, politicizing our understanding of body image. And what had gone viral after that was this completely fake DM. So it looked as if I had been messaging some other person, and the other person looks like misidentified, like the name is like blacked out, so you can't tell who it is. And it looks like I'm saying something that is pro-Holocaust. Like I'm saying something that looks anti-Semitic. I know. And it looks like I'm saying something that says, absolutely, yes, more Jewish people should have died after World War II. That's what it looked like I was saying in this DM. But my platform has like really grown in the last year. And so I actually have a really strict policy where I don't respond to DMs. In my bio, it says DMs are closed. So there's no way that it could have happened, that I could have engaged with this other person. And what some followers had told me was that it probably was created through an app called PrankGram, where it looks like you could have a conversation. You can make up a conversation with anybody. Like you can, it could look like you and I had a conversation about eating rainbow cupcakes last week in Denver, and you had never been there.
Unbelievable. It is believable. It's really scary.
It's terrifying because the screenshot alone, and then someone had taken a video as if someone was like scrolling up and down through that DM. That went, I don't know if viral is even the right word, but people were pushing it. Like Zionists on Instagram were pushing it, and they were organized. They had sent in complaints to the Pennsylvania State Licensing Board, the Social Work Licensing Board. And they had said that I was anti-Semitic and here was the visual evidence. And Pennsylvania actually would not approve my license until the investigation was cleared. And I haven't told anyone this publicly because I really wanted to wait until the investigation closed. But in Pennsylvania, I was waiting for my license to get approved for like 5 months, paying rent on this office that I couldn't use.
Wow.
I mean, I feel like being in Boston, like we ran into this sentiment like on a regular basis, especially my partner. While I was at Boston College, she was getting her master's in public policy at Brandeis University, which is predominantly it was founded as like a Jewish institution. And so like it's just wild to hear people equate like having, you know, supporting the liberation of the Palestinian people and like a move to end occupation as being anti-Semitic.
It's wild to me because, you know, one of my good friends has read a lot about Zionism and actually how many lobbying groups have been co-opted by Zionism. And here in the U.S., they're infiltrating like student governments and college campuses. But what's actually really anti-Semitic is this idea that like Jews should leave all nations and actually only go live in one place in the world, in Israel. Like, actually, that's really anti-Semitic, guys. Jewish people should be able to live everywhere. So, like, actually, the project of Israel is itself an anti-Semitic project. this idea that like only Jewish people should live there and that it should be the hub and that they shouldn't live anywhere else.
And I know you mentioned like sometimes people can lose their jobs, and speaking of Philadelphia, Mark Lamont Hill,
absolutely,
I think he made a speech to the United Nations and he lost his job at Temple.
That's right. And CNN.
Yeah.
The same happened to Dr. Angela Y. Davis. She lost her award because of her vocal vocal views about Palestinian liberation. And thankfully, she was reinstated that award. But it took a lot of lobbying on behalf or by Jewish anti-Zionists. Mm-hmm. They were the only ones who were able to stand up to their Jewish Zionist community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if the listeners haven't already checked out Professor Angela Davis's book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement, I feel like she really gets at really succinctly and really well just how much all of these movements are interconnected. Just kind of reflecting on the things that you're bringing up, Sonali, and just the ways in which all of these movements are interconnected. And I'm thinking about Palestine, and even still after 71 years, how this continues to be invisibilized by a lot of major media. I'm also thinking about like Kashmir right now. And I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on the situation there right now? And just like the intersections that are happening there as well in the movement and I don't know, like, Anything that you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, there are direct parallels to what's happening in Kashmir. Kashmir has been occupied for a little more than three decades. And the militarization that we're seeing in Kashmir actually outranks Palestine. So Kashmir is the most militarized place in the entire world, where soldiers will outnumber residents sometimes like 3-1. And this is Indian Army soldiers. These are people who have been reported for committing mass sexual violence against the occupied Kashmir peoples. Of course, lynchings, stonings, the same type of things that we see in occupied Palestine also, like incarcerating children and bullying and intimidating children. What's happening in Kashmir and India more generally, more broadly, is really scary because the rise of Hindu fascism, because so much of media is US-centric, we orientalize this understanding of Hinduism and think that it's like really warm and spiritual and inviting and, you know, namaste, and we do yoga and you know, we worship cows, and cows are beautiful farm animals. But what's happening in India when we think about Hindu fascism is so violent, and it has existed like that for decades with the rise of the RSS. So what's so scary about Hindu fascism is that it was inspired by Nazis, and it currently inspires Nazis.
Mm.
So when you think of like how Hitler, right? Hitler Germany appropriated or co-opted the swastika imagery. That comes from Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
And current Hindu fascist uniforms take aspects of like Mussolini's uniforms and Hitler's uniforms to create their own look of like authoritarianism. In India, what's being constructed are the early stages of concentration camps in the southern portions of India that will house roughly the 1 to 3 million individuals who have been disenfranchised by the state. It's terrifying. And we are not seeing the type of anti-India protests and anti-Hindu fascism protests outside of India. We're not seeing anything like that within India because there's so much state repression and fear of backlash. So folks who exist in the diaspora have like sometimes a greater privilege to say something, speak out, protest. Those living within India actually experience a lot of physical danger in doing that.
Mm.
It's a really scary time.
I want to thank you for dropping jewels and you know, being brave and using your platform. You know, I think it's absolutely wonderful, but I think we can bring attention to the risk involved. This isn't a game. This is real life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And livelihood is at stake. So I just want to, again, thank you for being brave and talking that talk.
Thank you. And I'm not even a Palestinian. Like, I know Palestinian and anti-Zionist Jewish folks who get put on Canary Mission and will lose, like, jobs and gigs because they're publicly named as being part of, like, the anti-Israel movement. Mm-hmm. So it could be worse for me. It could be even worse.
Mm-hmm. You're an inspiration to me. Just hearing about all these things, I'm like, man, you know, there's some stuff that I go through, but I'm just going to think about you and have you in mind with some of these things so I can press through the powers that be in this place called Boston. So, thank you very much. It's very impressive.
Bruh. Bro, you're talking about Boston as if it's like a plantation, my guy.
Well, I mean, Faneuil Hall used to be plantation. Downtown Crossing used to be plantations.
Man.
You know? They call Rhode Island Plantation.
Oh, man. Thank you, Josh. It's been a good amount of time since we got a really angry message from someone from Boston.
Yo, they're
going to be hitting the DMs very soon.
Hold my beer real quick.
Boston should not be complaining. They're like one of the most segregated cities in the country, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
It's white Atlanta.
Man, you're right.
Ooh, I've never heard
white people come from all over. Come to, I'm gonna go to Boston this week and we're gonna have fucking fun.
Yeah.
Going back, many people can connect weight to health, right? They think things like diabetes, heart disease, etc., are reasons why some people want to lose weight. What are your thoughts on people who just want to have fat people to lose weight for health purposes?
So a lot of these assumptions about fatness being connected to poor health is based on fatphobic weight science. And it exists without this like understanding and actually like very real contradiction that these disabilities, these health complications, these illnesses, weight range. Like thin people experience diabetes and heart issues too, right? And I think like that alone should be enough for us to like decouple thinness and health. And this idea that like with weight loss will come thin people's health, but thin people also have bad health. And so actually what we need to be doing is thinking about more creative ways to achieve better health outcomes that don't involve weight loss, because based on the science that I've been using, which is like real science and like not fatphobic science, the outcomes of intentional weight loss actually result in about a 95 to 97% failure rate. And so things that like achieve higher success rates than that are groundhogs predicting the outcome of spring and pulling out during sex, not resulting in pregnancy. These are two examples that have better success rates than intentional weight loss. Mm. So we might need to get rid of that idea altogether. And like, I struggle with it myself. I absolutely still struggle with internalized fat phobia. I was talking to my therapist a couple of weeks ago and I was like really upset at this idea that I might actually have to lose weight in order to experience better mobility and like maybe just less joint pain in general. Because there's this idea that like, oh, if we have less pressure in our joints, then we'll experience less pain. But actually, like, I could idealize thinness in that way and think that, yeah, when I'm thinner, I'll have less pain and I'll have more joy and I'll have more love in my life and I'll be happier and things will just be easier. Mm-hmm. But actually what I could do is go to the gym and lift weights and increase my strength in my knees. And that could also cause and experience less pain. That could result in less pain in my body. Mm-hmm. Just as easily.
So you get comments that you are encouraging people to be unhealthy. What do you say to these haters?
Thank you for calling them haters. That's what they are. I think that they are individuals who just operate from like really different worldviews than I do. Like they believe that thinness is coupled with health. And I don't exist in that assumption. I don't believe that my food has a moral value and that I'm a better person if I eat carrots and if I don't eat cake. I don't believe that I'm magically going to be a happier person if I lose mm-hmm. X amount of weight. I don't believe that I'm magically going to find love in my life if I change my body and succumb to the pressure of fat phobia and assimilate into the thin ideal. I don't actually think that that's going to come with those positive results. So I do think that people who believe that I'm promoting unhealthiness are not actually considering the full understanding of what health is. So health is not just physical health. Health is also emotional and social health. Right. So when we look at the World Health Organization's data on what actually predicts the longevity of someone's life, it has really little to do with how much they weigh. It has a lot to do with their social connectedness and how isolated they feel, how lonely they feel. And you know this as clinicians, right? Like you're clients who have strong emotional connections with their community have better outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. The same is true. The same is true for us.
We all need that connection with others. And that's you know, from attachment to how to your lifelong, you know, trajectory. You know, it's all about that connection that you have with people. And also, for those that may not have the right language, for those that want to be identified due to whatever their body image is, what is the right language for those? You know, I've heard that some people say it's not right to say fat, or some people may say full figured. Or when I was a little kid, my grandpa used to call me big boned. So what is the right language to use?
So it's definitely a person by person basis. Mm-hmm. I specialize in working with fat clients who are working through internalized fat phobia, along with other issues, like they might be working through attachment stuff, growing up in a family with emotionally immature parents, codependency issues, sexual trauma, all kinds of stuff. But I always ask a client what they prefer to use, and I pay attention to the words that they use to describe themselves. Mm. Because of my specialty, I will ask them why they are not using the word fat, because with my reclamation of the word fat, with the purposes of the fat liberation movement, the purpose of reclaiming it is to like destigmatize it and to just think of it like a descriptor without a tone of judgment and shame. So I use the word fat. I do not ever use the word obese. Obese is considered a fat phobic slur. It is an instant way to communicate to your fat client that you might be someone who is unsafe for them to talk about their experiences of fat phobia. Mm-hmm. It's the same way you think of any other slur. Mm-hmm. I also do not use the term overweight, because over what weight? Mm. Right. It's this assumption that there's like a normal range and that everyone who is outside of it is weird and bad and not good. Mm-hmm. So I try to use the word fat, but if my client is using words like fluffy, chubby, plus size, I will use that language and then also try to push them and challenge them. To try to better understand why they're not using the word fat and why it still feels triggering. And then, of course, exploring those like that body image trauma underneath the charge of the word, the emotional charge.
Mm-hmm. Now, a great rapper once said, fat and black and ugly as ever. However, I stayed coochie down to the sweater. That young man was known as Christopher Wallace. Now, with that being said, do you have any, you know, clients that identify as male that have come out of vulnerability and talk about their images as well?
Absolutely. And having body image issues doesn't have a type, doesn't have a look. Experiencing eating disorders doesn't have a look. Often when I'm working with clients and they're experiencing body image issues, they're often undernourishing themselves. Mm-hmm. Or they might be experiencing some type of disordered eating. And it could be for a host of reasons, but absolutely. Mm-hmm. Clients of all shapes and sizes, and especially men, come to me because often the pressures of masculinity come with this idea of constantly aspiring toward attaining various externally valued status symbols. And so one of them can be the way that the body looks, in the way that muscularity and fatness are distributed on the body. Some can come with body hair, skin color, who that person is partnered with and what that other person looks like, how desirable the other person is that male is partnered to. It comes with a host of other things like money, status, career.
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, men, they probably don't talk about it as much. And I grew up playing sports where, I'll be honest, like, I grew up like, man, I got to get bigger. I got to work out. My arms got to be this big. I got to squat this much, because you're always comparing yourself because you want to be faster, stronger, bigger, and kind of, in a sense, more alpha male than the next. And I think that is definitely a discussion that doesn't get discussed as much. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So I think we're kind of drawing to a close. If you could take me to 5 dope restaurants in Philadelphia, because I do want to come in the future, or maybe Melanated Social, all of us can come to Philadelphia, what are those 5 spots that you would love to take us to?
Also, for a bonus, I did notice in your Instagram profile that you're a donut queen, and I love donuts. Like, my pursuit in life is to find the best donut. So if you throw in a donut shop, I would love that.
and donuts and restaurants. What's up?
Can I just say, you asked the right person. You asked the real foodie. You asked the right person this question. So depending on food allergies and dietary restrictions, I would take you to Vientiane Cafe, which offers a Laotian Thai fusion experience. That involves
an experience.
One of the best things I've ever eaten, which is a vegetarian dish. And I'm like a meat eater. I'm an omnivore. But it's a vegetarian naan salad, which has like lettuce wraps and this like crispy fried rice and like garlic, shallots, lime, peanuts, coconut. Incredible. It's like a little bit spicy, a little bit savory, a little bit sweet. I would take you to Vientiane Cafe. I would take you to Chinatown to get some Sichuan, maybe Bai Wei, or to get dim sum at Joysen Lau or Dim Sum Garden. I would take you to Chinatown to get Malaysian food at Banana Leaf or Penang. I would take you to get artisanal pasta at William Mulheron & Sons. It's pricey, but it's delicious. I would take you to South Philly to get spicy Thai food at Kalaya. Like, so spicy, like, you will regret it the next day.
Uh-oh. Tums. Do I need some Tums and Rolaids, huh? Fuck
me up.
I would take you to get my favorite cheesesteak, which is at D'Alessandro's. I would take you to, now we are kind of a donut desert. We do not have a great donut selection here.
Okay.
But there is a new shop that just opened that has some good stuff. It's called Hello Donuts. I would take you there. They have a risen yeast donut that is filled with lemon curd and dusted with powdered sugar.
Ooh.
Chef's kiss.
Okay.
I love it.
Say no more.
I think we got to make a trip to Philly, y'all.
Yup.
Let's say we in there.
Well, thank you for being on our podcast. Thanks for educating us. Thanks for being an inspiration. And, you know, when one of us in Philly, I got the first meal.
All right. Yeah, thank you so much, Sonali. I feel like this was amazing. Like, in terms of being the first guest on the podcast, you really set the bar, like, so high for everyone to come after you. Like, yo, so appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It was an honor to be here. Thank you so much. A pleasure.
Yeah, it was an honor to have you. Thank you.
All right, y'all. That's it. Peace.
Peace.